If you're watching the two new fantasy series going head-to-head, episode by episode, House of the Dragon and The Rings of Power, you may be interested in which one's winning the hearts and minds of viewers, which seems complicated. The Tolkien fans globally appear to be more loyal than the George Martin fans, perhaps, I was reading. Evidently, The Rings of Power had more audience retention early in the season. But one is for general viewing and the other is adult viewing, so it's like comparing orcs with wyverns. Wyverns are dragons that can't breathe fire. Speaking of dragons, they're in the house in the Game of Thrones prequel, but not in the Lord of the Rings prequel. But of course, Tolkien had dragons first, and they may yet make an appearance, I don't know. There are dragons and there are dragons. Once upon a time, this was the world's best-known dragon.
Puff the magic dragon lived by the sea and frolicked in the autumn mist in a land called Hanalei. Little Jackie Paper loved that rascal Puff and brought him strings and sealing wax and other fancy stuff. Oh, Puff the magic dragon lived by the sea and frolicked in the autumn mist in a land called Hanalei.
Peter, Paul and Mary and their New Zealand tours in the 1960s were huge, as was the endless discussion about what those lyrics really meant. But the dragons we talk about now have got less cuddly and more deadly.
When I heard the sound of thundering hooves, splintering shields and ringing swords, and I placed my hand upon the Iron Throne, and all the dragons roared as one.
Whatever dragons you prefer, big questions still arise. For a start, how could they fly? Fantasy may be full of creatures and abilities that defy reality, but we look at dragons and perhaps we think they'd just never get off the ground. Well, they could, says Dr. Guy Grattan. Guy's a professor of aviation in the UK, currently a visiting senior research fellow in aeronautics at Brunel University in London. He's also a qualified mechanical engineer with extensive experience in aircraft design. He's got a commercial pilot's license himself, and he's been involved in military flight testing and also light aircraft and microlight testing and certification. In fact, his PhD was in the development of flight test techniques. And we find him in the United States at the moment. Hello, Guy.
Hello, how are you?
Very well. Have you been watching the House of the Dragon series at all? Have you had time?
I confess I haven't yet. I'm going to wait for it to come out on a box set, and then I can have a proper binge session and watch it right through, which is the way I enjoyed the first series.
Now, let's talk about dragons. You say that a fully grown dragon looks to weigh, what, about 2,600 kgs? That's what you've worked out?
Thereabouts, yes. So what I did is I took some of the images off the screen and I looked at Daenerys Targaryen, who is obviously the human being who spends the most time around dragons without getting burned or eaten. And we've got a reasonable idea of her size, shape, weight. And I basically scaled up, assuming the dragons would be of a similar density to her. And that was the figure I came up with.
Okay. And the world of Westeros, and it doesn't matter at all if people haven't seen this world, we've all read about dragons of one kind or another, but Westeros would have had the same, or would have the same gravity as Earth. We can kind of take that as a given.
Well, that was my assumption. Again, just watching the films, you see people moving and walking around and they seem to be the same size and shape as us and they move in the same way. And that led me to this question. Okay, let's ignore magic because magic's cheating and see what we could do to actually make it possible for these dragons to fly. So what I did is I could see what the size and the weight of the dragons were. We know what big winged things, aeroplanes, birds, whatever, fly like in terms of particularly the lifting coefficients and the stalling characteristics. stall being the point as you decelerate a flying thing when it loses control and ceases to be able to fly properly. And of course, you generally land and take off at the point of the stall, and there's no reason to believe a dragon would be any different to a bird or an aeroplane in that. So I was able to play around with some maths, and I showed that if this was in normal Earth atmosphere, these dragons would have to have a lifting coefficient of about 36. And that just doesn't work. The best we've got pretty much for any aeroplane is about 2.7, maybe 3 with something very clever. Maths basically said the density of the atmosphere needed to be around about 10 times what you and I are breathing at the moment. That sounds a lot, but actually that's only about the same as a diver would be experiencing at 100 meters. So we know people can survive at that. I then said, well, okay, let's say it's not 21% oxygen, 78% nitrogen, 1% other stuff, which again is what we're breathing at the moment. So where could we go with this? Well, we up the oxygen to about 30%. That makes it a bit more dense and allows us to drop the air pressure a little bit. Much more than 30%, you pretty much have an explosive atmosphere.
And with a denser atmosphere, you see evidence for this theory in the way that spears and other missiles are thrown in the series.
Yeah, so if you push the density up, the dragons aren't the only thing that's going to fly better. If they had aeroplanes, they would fly better, but they obviously don't. But a spear, for example, a spear does generate lift as it flies through the air. And if you've got that higher density, if you were to throw a spear, it would go further, it would be a much flatter trajectory than it is for you and I here. And that does seem to be the evidence that we see on Game of Thrones, that people throw missiles at each other at phenomenal distances and manage to kill each other with monotonous regularity. Now, the nitrogen that we're breathing is inert, but it's not particularly heavy. And if we go to argon, which is actually the third most common gas in our atmosphere after oxygen and nitrogen, that's about 40% more dense. And again, that allows us to drop down the pressure a few bar. So we end up with around 7 or 8 bar, which again is, it's equivalent to being say 70 meters underwater. But they've still got the density that would allow the dragons to fly successfully.
Okay, so more argon. If Westeros has 30% oxygen or thereabouts in the air, wouldn't there be a lot of forest fires and cooking mishaps turning into blazes that burn down castles and things?
Yeah, but they do seem to keep burning their castles down, so that might be consistent.
If that composition of atmospheric gases could see a dragon fly, what other effects would it have? I mean, could you, like people once tried to do, strap some wings onto yourself and leap off tall buildings and flap?
Yeah, probably. I mean, I think we'd still struggle with the strength of our arms. Our arms were not built to take our weight for long periods, and certainly they're not in a flapping motion. But certainly you'd be able to make things that were crude hang gliders and be able to fly those quite successfully. And it would be a lot easier to achieve manned flight in that atmosphere.
Would that kind of atmosphere have any kind of hallucinatory effect or effect on our brain?
Well, yes, and that was one of the more fun things that came out of the bit of research I did. So it turns out there was research done a few years back on what they called Argox, which was an argon oxygen mix for use by deep sea divers, actually for exactly the same reason, to allow them to have the density of air into their lungs without having to be at too high a pressure. And what was discovered, I think it was the United States Navy were experimenting with this, is it was mildly narcotic. it tended to cause people to start behaving irrationally, which of course would describe most of the characters of Game of Thrones, because they all do seem to be, to use the vernacular, nutty as fruitcakes.
Might that account for the wars in our own history? You know, there are periods of peace, and perhaps the oxygen-argon mixture changes according to some as-yet-undiscovered law of chemistry without being measured, and people start getting a bit excited and antsy.
This is a bit outside of my expertise. I don't believe historically we've had that much of a change in our atmosphere. On the other hand, we probably drink massively less alcohol than we have done historically, when it was the best way to make sure what we were drinking was clear of germs. Yeah. So I think it's quite possible that it's what our ancestors were drinking that made them so aggressive, rather than what they were breathing.
Dr. Guy Grattan is with us. I was reading in the Journal of Vertebrate Paleontology, as you do, that we had our own dragons once, you know, ancient reptiles that were a bit dragon-like and glided from tree to tree like flying squirrels. But they'd be too light-boned to be much of a threat in our atmosphere, wouldn't they?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I don't think those pterosaurs flew in the way that modern birds do. I think they were essentially quite efficient gliders. So they would tend, the assumption is they climbed trees or cliffs, and perhaps they had a lot of skill in using thermals in the way that some soaring birds do today. I mean, I've been flying in the US the last couple of weeks, and looking up from my aeroplane and seeing vultures that seem to be a lot higher than me and putting a lot less effort into it. So that's certainly possible.
I knew your work had taken you to the US at the moment. So are you flying yourself across the country?
I was in Florida last week, and I was actually just revalidating my American pilot's license and getting a bit of practice while I was at it. This week I'm actually at the annual symposium of the Society of Experimental Test Pilots, the people whose job it is to evaluate new modified research aeroplanes, certainly other people's electric flight projects around the world, as we're all learning how to try and create aircraft that create much less severe emissions than what we're all flying right now.
What's the likely time frame, do you think, for long distance electric flight?
Well, that's a tough one. The aircraft we're flying at the moment, which are battery electric, are frankly not very efficient. I'm flying an aeroplane in the UK right now called the E-Cub, which will give us around about an hour and a quarter's flying with one pilot, no passengers, no payload. Well, that's clearly not going to get anybody on their holidays. And the only certified electric aeroplane in the world at the moment is a Slovenian aircraft called the Pipistrel Velis Electro. And that will give you around about 45 minutes with two people, plus around 20 minutes of safety reserves. Again, just about good enough as a training aeroplane, but it won't do much else for you. I think we are waiting on technology waves. We need to develop the next stages of technology to see really where it's going to go. Most of the smart money is either on hydrogen, which will still be electric, because what we will do is put hydrogen into a fuel cell, which is basically like a chemical battery. It will react with oxygen from the air and create electricity and water. The water you just dump over the side, the electricity you use to provide thrust. The other is hybridization, where we use a mixture of maybe hydrogen, maybe conventional fuels and batteries, very like a hybrid car, to optimize that mix to create it as efficiently as possible. I think my money would be on us seeing an increasing number of all electric aeroplanes for things like training and sports over the next five-ish years. And then I think we're going to see hybrid, and I think we're going to see hydrogen products, and they're essentially going to be competing for dominance. And I don't think we know yet which is going to win, but certainly I'd say in around 10 years, one or both of those technologies will be taking people in sort of 20 to 50 passenger aircraft between cities, or say between North and South Islands in New Zealand, which I know Air New Zealand are actively pursuing at the moment.
Yeah.
After that, I think it's too early to know what the next technology wave after that is going to be. It would be wonderful if somebody's going to come up with some new, much better batteries, but we really need batteries that weigh around 5 times less than the current best lithium batteries, and we don't see that on the horizon yet. It could well be better hydrogen, particularly if the chemical engineers do a much better job of creating green hydrogen, which is to say producing hydrogen without using fossil fuels. So that could well be the next technology wave after that. And ultimately, those will be electric airplanes, because that use of hydrogen or that mix with batteries is going to be relying on electricity and electric motors.
Okay. Interesting to get that glimpse of the future from you. Just concluding with more glimpses into magic. What about breathing fire? I mean, I suppose that would be easier for a dragon with so much oxygen, but you'd think it would burn a dragon's mouth, and no one ever talks about this.
That's a really interesting question. I don't really know. It's a very long time since I did chemistry at school, and sort of engineering and flying have been much more my thing. I suppose it's reasonable to assume that you might develop organs that are very heat resistant. I'm just thinking about the fact that the Chinese space program use a form of oak as a heat shield for their spacecraft on re-entry. So there are certainly natural materials that could take a lot of heat. So how they would create the fire, I'm less sure. I think if we read Anne McCaffrey's wonderful science fiction novels, Dragonflight, and it's set on the world of Pern, she has fire-breathing dragons. But she creates this whole thing about them having to chew a rock containing inflammable materials, and then they breathe that out.
Right.
So I don't know. It's a fun question. That might need a chemist to write that paper, not an engineer.
I saw one opinion once that the whole dragon mythology may have arisen from a dead lizard about to be cooked for the evening meal when its last methane burp ignited out of its mouth with a spark from the fire. I've always thought about that.
Well, I live in a country that's got legends of dragons. The Welsh dragons are very much part of that country's mythology. I think the biggest lizards we've ever had in this country are around 6 inches long. So I think possibly that might not be how we got our dragons here, but maybe in some other country.
Great to have your mathematics and physics applied to this question, and very good to talk with you, Guy. Thank you so much for your time.
A real pleasure to talk to you.